York City on the evening of November 13th, 2007. This series of debates is sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation, and the proposition this time is, it's time to end affirmative action. The audience was polled before and after the event. We'll have the final results later. But the entry poll showed that the crowd was opposed to the motion. They voted 44% against it, while only 34% were in favor. 22% were undecided. There are three panelists on each side, and each gives an opening statement. And we'll sample only one opening statement from each side, starting with Joseph C. Phillips. He's an actor, and he's the author of He Talked Like a White Boy. He's speaking in favor of the motion, it's time to end affirmative action.
And actually, the excitement. Because I'm here in defense of what I think is one of the cornerstones of our republic, that of non-discrimination. And I think it was articulated in Brown versus the Board of Education when decided that discrimination in our public schools was unconstitutional. It became part of our cultural lexicon a few years later when Presidents Kennedy and Johnson issued an executive order that stated clearly and unambiguously that affirmative action should be taken to ensure that hiring decisions were made without regard to race. And then, of course, it was given teeth in the law through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was very clear that discrimination based on race was unlawful. That was then. That was good old-fashioned non-discrimination, and it was good for America. Well, times have changed, and what we're talking about now, affirmative action, is no longer about non-discrimination. It's about racial preferences, and that is what we oppose, racial preferences. Now, that doesn't mean that we believe that racism has suddenly disappeared. It hasn't. We know that racism exists. Listen, I'm 45 years old. I've been black in America for a long time. I have seen racism. I have been the victim of racism. I'm not about to stand up here and pretend that it doesn't exist. But the question before us is not, does racism exist? The question is, are racial preferences an effective means to combat racism? And the answer is simply no. There isn't any evidence at all that racial preferences actually benefits us in terms of our race relations. In fact, what evidence there is points to just the opposite. What we do know is that racial preferences tend to enhance and firm up negative stereotypes, particularly as it pertains to black intellectual capacity and academic capabilities. You know, there was a saying that my mother had, and I hear it in my head right now. There is no monopoly on brain power. That's what my mother said all the time. There is no monopoly on brain power. Black people can compete. We can compete on the athletic fields. We can compete in the symphony halls. And we can compete in the classrooms. And what's more, my mother said, you can compete and you will compete. But there are some folks who, sadly, are going to tell my children something very different. And you don't have to take my word for it. Let's just look at what they say. Richard Atkinson, former president of the University of California at Berkeley, standing before an audience similar to this at University of San Diego, said that it was highly doubtful, if not impossible, that we would achieve diversity on our nation's premier campuses without the use of racial preferences. Now, Atkinson was not standing before a curious world telling everybody he's just a big fat racist, and unless you rein me in, I'm going to start discriminating right and left. No. What he was saying is that there is a monopoly on brain power, and that black students don't have it in sufficient quantity to show up in significant numbers in our nation's campuses. Now, if you're not sufficiently offended, as you should be, let's take something else that you often hear in discussions like this. Someone, maybe here, over here, is bound to stand up and say, well, I benefited from affirmative action. You benefited from affirmative action. She benefited from affirmative action. And of course, they're not saying, well, you benefited from non-discrimination. Well, I did, and that's a good thing. What they're saying is, I couldn't qualify, you couldn't qualify, she couldn't qualify. Absurd. Miss Kimberly Crenshaw there. I've met her for the first time. I've read what she's written. I've heard her on the radio. This is a smart, dynamic woman. The idea that but for racial preferences, Ms. Crenshaw would be standing on a corner singing doo-wop someplace is offensive to me, and it should be offensive to all in the sound of my voice. Now, you're going to hear a lot of statistics today. I'm not going to talk to you about statistics. I'm going to talk to you about people, because racial preferences impact and affect people. This past spring, my wife was at a birthday party with our children, and the mothers are sitting there talking. If the father's in there, you know that you tend to avoid these things like the plague, so I wasn't there. But the mothers are grouped, and they're talking about their children, where they go to school, and it comes to light that my oldest boy attends a magnet program for highly gifted students. Without missing a beat, one of the other mothers says, well, you know, now with this Supreme Court decision, they won't be able to accept kids in these programs for diversity. Well, my wife was kinder than I would have been. After she picked her jaw up off the floor, she explained to the woman, look, he's not in this program because he checked some box. You can't get in this program unless you score 99.9% on the test. And he's making straight A's in this program. And what is more ironic is that the woman she was talking to is a teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District. That is the evil of racial preferences. That is the real-life impact of racial preferences. Teachers who lack faith in the academic abilities of their students, and children who, no matter how hard they work, no matter how broad their gifts, are stained with preference. And my child is not the only one. There are thousands and thousands of students just like him who cannot enter our nation's college campuses boldly and confidently. They enter, again, dripping with the stigma of racial preferences. And I'm here to tell you tonight that that is not good for America. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph Phillips, speaking in favor of the motion. Now, to make an opening statement against the motion, it's time to end affirmative action. Tim Wise.
You know, it always amazes me to hear critics of affirmative action speak about this subject as if racial preference were something that were invented in the 60s to benefit people of color. Because in fact, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, and of course we don't, the entire history of this country is the history of affirmative action for white folks like myself. And unless we begin by discussing that affirmative action and the impact that it has had, we engage in a discussion that is both ethically and practically irresponsible. Contrary to what Joseph tells you, this debate is about the extent to which racism still exists, because it is indeed the existence of that racism which necessitated affirmative action in the beginning and continues to necessitate it today. Whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, enslavement, Indian genocide, segregation did not only oppress people of color, they elevated white folks and provided us with opportunities that we did not in fact earn. The Homestead Act allowed whites to claim over 270 million acres of land for virtually nothing down at a time when folks of color could not. Today, there are 40 million white folks descended directly from those who received that land giveaway, millions of them still living on the property. They owe their lives to affirmative action. Then there was the FHA home loan program, which for the first 30 years of its existence operated in a whites-only fashion, lending over $120 billion worth of government-backed housing equity to whites, thereby creating the white middle class. And in large measure, because of those preferences, the typical black college-degreed couple starts out with less than one-fifth the net worth of the typical young white couple, because the latter of those has likely received the benefits of their family's prior head start, while the former are likely to have accumulated far less, having had less chance to do so. So against that backdrop, ending affirmative action would only further cement the systemic advantages for whites that have been in place for hundreds of years. It would be tantamount to favoring those three laps ahead in a five-lap race, even though those who were ahead gained their head start as the result of an unfair process. But even worse, To end affirmative action would ignore the ongoing reality, not past, but ongoing reality of white racial preference, and not only in education, but also in employment. And let me clarify, we were not told that our remarks tonight had to focus only on higher education. That resolution doesn't mention higher education. I will not speak of it only with regard to schools, because it is not only there that it matters. According to the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, 3 out of 4 companies covered by affirmative action regulations violate them regularly, and not just that, but are also in violation of basic civil rights law. The problem is the OFCCP only has enough monitors to check up on the companies under their purview once every 46 years. So there's no deterrent. Those who would end affirmative action ignore the study, recent study, which found that job applicants with white-sounding names have a 50% greater chance of getting a call back for an interview than those with black-sounding names, even when qualifications are indistinguishable. They ignore not only that, but the research which has found that 8 in 10 jobs are never advertised. Instead, they're filled by networking, a process that mostly excludes people of color and women of all colors and elevates whites and men, not because we are better for certain jobs, but because we know the right people. And if affirmative action were abolished, none of that would change for the better. If anything, it would get worse. The same is true for schooling. Our opponents will rail against so-called preferences for students of color while they ignore the preferences built in for whites. So they condemn the University of Michigan for giving 20 points on a 150-point scale to students of color, but they ignored the points that were in practice essentially for whites only. Like the 16 points you got if you were from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The snow is not the only thing white there. The 10 points just because you went to a top high school, which means your parents lived in the right zip code. The 8 points for taking advanced placement classes, which are 3 times more available in schools serving white kids than schools that serve mostly students of color, or the 4 points you got if daddy went to Michigan. They rallied behind Jennifer Gratz as the supposed victim of reverse discrimination because the year she was rejected, there were about 85 students of color who got into Michigan despite having lower scores in grades, but they say nothing about the 1,400, let me repeat, 1,400 white students with lower grades and lower scores than Jenny Gratz who got in. You see, less qualified white people are no problem, but less qualified people of color, my goodness, we can't have that. They say nothing about the study from...
That was Tim Wise. He's the author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son. We'll hear more from this Intelligence Squared debate on affirmative action in just 1 minute.
This is Focus 580 host David Inge reminding you all the programs you hear on AM 580 are made possible by the financial contributions of our listeners.
You're listening to an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition, it's time to end affirmative action. And here's another excerpt from the opening statement against that motion given by Tim Wise. Here, he's continuing to talk about the forces against affirmative action.
That. They say nothing about the study from 6 weeks ago which found that for every 1 student of color who receives any benefit from affirmative action in college, there are at least 2 whites for every 1 person of color, 2 whites who also didn't meet the requirements but got in because daddy wrote a check or mama made a phone call or somebody pulled strings and got them in. But affirmative action for rich white people is never a problem for the folks like our opponents. While they insist affirmative action is racist because it holds people of color to lower standards, the fact is it is whites who have been held to lower standards. It is whites, and only whites, I would suggest, who can get C's all the way through school, brag about their mediocrity publicly, mangle the English language, and go on to become president of the United States. So when they lament the supposed damage done to students of color by affirmative action because it supposedly forces them to question their abilities, ask yourself, why no concern for the mental health and self-image of white Americans who have been being preferred for 400 years, and if their argument is correct, must be the most self-hating people on the face of planet Earth? And no, affirmative action doesn't place people of color in positions for which they're unqualified. Indeed, once we control for economic status, comparing only whites and folks of color from families with both the same income and wealth profile, there is no difference in college graduation rates and only an insignificant difference in college grades. And black students at the most selective schools actually do better in relation to their white counterparts than those in less selective schools. Furthermore, according to 200 different studies on the subject, employees who have benefited from affirmative action perform equal to or better than their white male counterparts once given a chance to prove themselves. So in closing, unless our opponents can show you that they have some alternative mechanism for addressing that legacy of white racial preference and the ongoing advantages extended to whites in this country, unless they can demonstrate some alternative means by which true equal opportunity can flourish, to vote for them and to vote for ending affirmative action is to engage in an act of irresponsible racial aggression. It is to ignore the wisdom of Dr. King, who said quite clearly in 1963, quote, "Whenever this issue of compensatory or preferential treatment is raised, some of our friends recoil in horror. The Negroes should be granted equality, they insist, but should ask for nothing more. While at first that seems reasonable, in fact it is unrealistic, for it is obvious that if you take a man and put him at the starting line of a race 300 years after another man, the first man, would have to perform some incredible feat in order to catch up," end of quote. And to end affirmative action...
That was Tim Wise. After the opening statements, I gave the panelists an opportunity to ask each other questions. Here's Joseph Phillips.
I'll ask this one. I'd like to know, I listened to Tim's speech and wanted to know, why is it that blacks, or that youth seem to think that blacks can only achieve when the playing field is level?
Well, I don't say that black folks can only achieve when the playing field is level. I'm making a moral argument that the playing field should be level, because for it not to be is an injustice. I'm talking about it from an ethical perspective. I happen to think people of, you know, Madam C.J. Walker was the first black millionaire, and she made it in 1911 when 67 black folks got lynched. But I don't think we would say, well, hey, if Madam C.J. could make it, you know, all y'all could have made it. Because she was selling beauty products to black women that white folks didn't want to make. Good for her. But no one in their right mind would have said, see, everybody should go out there and work. So I think folks can succeed. The question is, what are our obligations as a society to create a level playing field? It has nothing to do with what the outcome can or cannot be. It has to do with what is right and what is just and what is proper. And I would guess, just a guess, that when people have equal opportunity, they are indeed more likely to succeed. I'm pretty willing to stand on that this evening.
Tim Wise now asks a question of John McWhorter, who's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and arguing for the motion.
John, you suggest that people of color are potentially less qualified, as evidenced by their college performance, maybe should go to less selective schools as a result. So given that, what should we conclude, the people in the audience and those of us up here, from the data which suggests that men, on average, also receive far lower college grades than women of all races and ethnicities? Does that mean that men are unqualified for the slots that they receive in colleges and law schools, and that maybe they should lower their sights to second and third tier schools and leave the best slots and opportunities for all the women? And if it doesn't mean that, why doesn't it mean that, given your argument about race?
John McWhorter, your answer.
Tim, I'm not sure that you're aware of the degree of the discrepancies that I'm talking about. I mean, we've long known about those particular gender discrepancies, and if we're going to talk about a kind of mindless bean counting, then no, I'm not in favor of that kind of address of racial preferences. But when you're dealing with schools which, before a ban on preferences, have a stark two-tiered system where black students are crashing and burning at much faster rates, then I think that in terms of arguing about morality and how we address the past and how we help people cope with a nation where I don't think that the playing field could ever possibly be perfectly level, that there is an issue for talking about racial preferences rather than what you're talking about.
Now, here's John McWhorter posing the next question to Kin May Ong. She's a staff attorney at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and she's against the motion.
Can I just ask you this? This is something that I saw when I taught at UC Berkeley. A very smart young woman during the ban on racial preferences told me that she was an undergraduate working in the recruiting office, was discouraging black applicants from coming to UC Berkeley if they made really high SAT scores and had really good grades. And I asked her why, and she said, in all seriousness, we're afraid that black students who perform at that high a level aren't going to have a social commitment to the black community at Berkeley. In other words, high achievers are not really black. How would you respond to the point that if standards are lowered for a particular group over a long period of time, after a while that may be the best that that group ever does because they've never been asked to do better?
Well, first of all, standards are not lowered. Diversity is a genuine benefit that occurs at an institution, both for the beneficiary and for other students at that institution. Secondly, beneficiaries of affirmative action are qualified. Students with very low test scores are never going to get it unless they happen to be legacies or children of donors. All beneficiaries of affirmative action have test scores and other criteria where they are able to succeed, and they do succeed. In this 1998 study by the two presidents of the university, Shape of the River, it found that black students at the most prestigious institutions actually graduated at a higher rate than black students at less selective institutions. They had very similar career arcs once they graduated. They had the same rate of getting advanced degrees, and they were actually more likely than whites to get advanced degrees in law, medicine, and business. So I would say that they are qualified and they are succeeding.
And your question now.
Before we move to the open discussion period, let's hear one more question from panelist Terrence Pell. He is for the motion, and he's president of the Center for Individual Rights. Here, he's addressing Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, the executive director of the African American Policy Forum.
Kimberly, if it turned out, if the evidence developed that race preferences or preferential policies turn out to pose barriers to minority success, would you reconsider your support for them?
I would certainly reconsider the actual form at which affirmative action takes place. However, I think that most affirmative action programs across the country actually try to attenuate themselves to the actual conditions. So you all are talking about affirmative action, racial preferences, as though they are one program. They actually function in one kind of way, when in fact there are hundreds of affirmative action programs, ranging from affirmative action in admissions, ranging from outreach programs, development programs, information programs. All of these forms of affirmative action have been shown to be effective for the particular obstacles that they are meant to overcome. The issue that I see is that for the most part, when we see various failures to perform, we tend to focus on the individuals rather than saying this is a wake-up call to our institutions. Our institutions know how to integrate equally. Do they know how to educate equally? That's the question that is raised.
Thank you. Kimberly Crenshaw, speaking and answering that question. She is one of our panelists opposed to the motion. We have lots of time for your questions for members of the audience right now. And we'll start by taking a question at a time. Here's a gentleman here.
Thank you very much. Booker T. Washington, if I'm correct, opposed legislative mandates to address racism, as did Barry Goldwater, who was anything but a racist, contrary to popular belief. I'd like to ask any of the panelists on either side to what extent, from a philosophical and constitutional perspective, either of those two gentlemen were right or wrong, and why.
Kimberly Crenshaw, you're the law professor. I'll turn to you first.
Well, it's not surprising that there have been African Americans throughout history who have disagreed, sometimes profoundly, with the positions of the majority of African Americans as to what kind of intervention should be put forward to better their condition. It's important to recognize in this context that every significant program that has ever been introduced to assist African Americans to actually achieve freedom and equality has been denounced as a preference, from the Emancipation Proclamation, which was seen as giving them a preference, giving them something that they didn't deserve, which was basically the value of their labor, to anti-discrimination law that would protect them in their rights to access to hotels and theaters, was seen as special treatment, to even the argument against segregation, which was seen as a preference. So the point of the matter is we have to always see these against the baseline in society. If we consider the baseline to be unfair, if we see the normal status quo as discriminatory, then these interventions are not seen as preferences. They're seen as equal opportunity. If, by contrast, we see society as basically benign, or we think it's okay that there are these deep structural differences that won't go away by ignoring it, but we think that's perfectly acceptable, then we'll understand these interventions as being preferential. I happen to be on the former side of the case. I think having structured inequality over centuries is inconsistent with the deepest values of America, and therefore any kind of intervention that is intending to try to bring about real equality is not preferential. It's in the deepest traditions of equality.
And does anybody on the side supporting the motion want to respond to
Booker
to
T. Washington?
John McWhorter
knew a very different world than ours. And I personally would not be in favor of his particular view that people really should just pick themselves up and that's all. Really, people do need help. He never knew the New Deal. He never knew the Great Society. He never knew affirmative action when it was first instituted, which I personally think was a very important thing given the situation in the country at the time. However, his basic insight that there does come a point when, in order to cope with an imperfect world, you have to do it yourself. There comes a point, is one that I think is valuable. One reads his writings now, and they're not nearly as reactionary and foreign as one would think. I think it's an advance in our society that we do have a safety net, that we do have things to, for example, help the poor. For me, socioeconomic preference makes perfect sense. The issue simply is that today, there is not nearly as large an overlap between disadvantage and having black skin as there was in 1960 or even 1970.
So when you argue it is time. When you argue it's time to end affirmative action, you would say this time is different from an earlier time.
It was about 15 years ago. Yeah,
about 15 years ago, it became time to end affirmative action. Sir.
Oh, hi. I had my undergrad studies back in China, but a lot of my classmates, we did a GRE test preparation. And I remember the time, you know, didn't have money, could not afford materials from the test center, so all we can prepare on is based on, you know, the past 10-year-old exams in the public. So, but the funny thing is, these guys all went into very high-level PhD programs, and
you have to come to the question now.
Actually beat U.S. people in a U.S. test, and if foreigners can do that, white people in the U.S. cannot.
Who wants to answer that question? Jim Wise?
I don't think it's a question of whether we ought to expect people to do well on tests. I think we ought to, and I think we ought to make it possible for folks to do so, no matter who's taking it, whether they are taking it from some other country, whether they're taking it from down the block. I think the real question, however, is whether or not we ought to be looking at that test, no matter how it's done on, by anyone, be they a foreigner or be they someone who is a citizen of the United States, as to whether that should be the criteria for admission. It seems to me that we ought to be looking at alternative criteria, including things like testing, but not overemphasizing those, because we know that, in fact, when those students who scored lower, who maybe didn't score as well as those at the very pinnacle, get in at places like the University of California, that only about 5% of their grade differences can be predicted by the test score. So they're not being mismatched. They're not unqualified. There are other things that recommend them for the spot. So we ought to expect and try to make sure everyone does well. We also ought to have a criteria that is both more fair and representative, but also more accurate. It doesn't serve anyone's interest to use a criteria that does not, in fact, predict success. And those tests simply do not. In fact, one study of law schools, University of Michigan study, found that there was an inverse relationship between LSAT score and future professional success, meaning that those who did better actually did worse and weren't as happy in their jobs when they got out of law school and started practicing. So by that criteria, we ought to let all the folks in who bombed the LSAT because they're going to make the best lawyers.
Next question from the audience.
Can I just add something to that as well? I mean, part of it is also you said that these foreigners were able to prep, which I would imagine means that they speak English and perhaps are from a professional background, that they knew about these tests. And I think that that is a big issue, that the access to the materials and access to information about the tests also isn't equally available.
Next question.
Good evening. Each of the panelists against the motion insists that the beneficiaries of affirmative action have been as successful as any other students in school. You know, if that's the case, should the children of those beneficiaries and the grandchildren of those beneficiaries, since it's been 40 years, should they continue to get the preferences afforded by affirmative action? And if it's not time to end it now, when is the time to end it?
Kim Crenshaw.
You know, one of the fallacies in this argument is the assumption that socioeconomic disadvantage has completely wiped out the ongoing reality of race disadvantage. Or to put it another way, people think that when we're talking about the black middle class, we're talking about the same thing as the white middle class. People think that sons and daughters of people with a college diploma are going to have the same kind of life circumstances as sons and daughters of white people with diplomas. In every major statistical finding about the actual life circumstances of African Americans, there are still a range of disadvantages that they face. Now, is it going to be the same level of affirmative action as someone who is truly impoverished? Of course not. But most affirmative action programs don't function that way. They give you benefits for both being socially, economically disadvantaged and race as well. The point is, race still marks life of African Americans.
Any comments
disadvantage,
on this from the movies? Joseph
range
Phillips.
Of disadvantage, disadvantages do not come with a black face. And this is why earlier I said we need to talk about people, because when we start talking these broad terms, we're talking about the black middle class. I happen to live in Los Angeles, down the street from Calabasas, California, which is one of the wealthiest communities in America. I coach football, and I have black kids on my team with parents who make more money than most, half of everybody in here added up together. The idea that these children are in need of preferences because they don't have access to the same benefits that their white counterparts is just ridiculous. Because we're not talking about individuals, suddenly we're talking about people generally in terms of their race. I also want to go back to address something else that was said, this idea of this testing. Look, right now, these are the tests that we're using. And I want you to listen very closely what we're talking about. Oh, the test, not the preparation, and on this. The underlying message is that our kids can't compete, that my three sons cannot compete, and I don't buy it. If we want to get rid of these tests, then let's get rid of them. Whatever standard we use, the standard should be applied equally to all kids. That's what we're saying here.
You're listening to an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the topic of affirmative action. We'll be discussing the implications for taxpayers of affirmative action in 1 minute. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is Intelligence Squared U.S. We'll now rejoin the discussion period with John McWhorter, who is arguing for the motion, it's time to end affirmative action.
I think that one thing that we are leaving out of the discussion, and you have to bring it in, is that much of the reason that middle-class black kids have trouble with submitting the same kind of file as a white kid would have is a tendency among black teens to say that it is white to do well in school. There is a myth nowadays that that has been disproven. And there are many studies, all of them show, even when they don't think they're showing it, that there is a strong tendency for black kids to tease each other that way. There are reasons for it. But the question is, how do racial preference programs address that particular problem, which I think is addressable and is being addressed by things that go on before kids go to college? We can't just leave that out of the discussion because the data is inconvenient, and I think it's absolutely crucial to the things that we're talking about.
And now we'll hear another question from the audience.
From the audience?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Let's say that it's irrelevant what Harvard and Yale do with private institutions. We're in New York City, the home of City University, a great publicly supported institution supported by all the taxpayers of New York City. So that when you have racial preferences, you are discriminating against taxpayers. Justify your position, those of you who are against the motion, to the taxpayers of New York City when they want to send their kids to higher education.
Okay. A distinction between public, taxpayer-funded, and private institutions. Tim Wise?
Sure. City College used to have open admissions because it recognized that its purpose was to serve all the citizens of the city of New York. And it did that for a while. A lot of white folks who wouldn't have passed any test actually went to City College under the era of open admissions. And yet, when all of a sudden people of color began to, quote-unquote, flood, being the metaphor we often use, that hallowed institution of higher learning, then all of a sudden we started talking about standards and criteria and remediation, and these people aren't really qualified. I think what taxpayers ought to expect is open access and ability to get into institutions they pay for, because to get rid of affirmative action at City College or any public institution is to say that people of color who pay taxes should not expect representation for the taxes that they pay. And the same is true in contracting, and the same is true in public employment. I think City College ought to have open admissions. It worked really well for a lot of white folks for decades, and I think it's a really good idea for students of color as well.
And let me just add,
Kimberly Crenshaw,
when this proposal was put on the table, it's talking about eliminating all affirmative action. Let me point out what difference it makes to have this conversation focus on African Americans. Would any of this make sense if we were talking about white women? Would we actually say, well, you know, it turns out that the scores for white women actually overpredict their performance in law schools. Because when they actually get to law schools, even though they're equally qualified, if you take these test scores as meaning qualification, they end up not scoring nearly as well as white men. Would we even suggest that? No. We would think that there's something going on in law school that actually has the effect of suppressing their performance. Would we talk about women's cultural values? Would we talk about their work ethic? Would we talk about any of these things if we were talking about white women? No. Would we talk about any of these things if we were talking about Asian Americans or even Latinos? So the reality is that we're actually trying to attack a wide variety of programs by having a debate that's as old as this republic about the intellectual inferiority of African Americans. I would submit that you should repudiate this proposition just because it's not talking about the full range of affirmative action and the beneficiaries who are at stake in this conversation.
Another question from the audience.
This is a question for the people who are for the motion. My first question is whether or not you agree that integrated educational settings, whether it be in K through 12 or higher education, are important. And then secondly, given the pervasive and serious inequalities that we see in K through 12 education by race, what it is that you propose to do to try and open up the pathways to those institutions?
Which of the supporters of the, motion?
I agree.
Terrence Bell.
I think that there's real value to integrated education. There's value to diversity. But that's not really what this debate is about. This debate is about one means used to achieve integration, one means used to achieve diversity. And the way that's been used to achieve diversity is highly mechanical and imposes a lot of costs on African American students in particular. And what we're saying is you got to look at those costs. You can't just sweep them off the table, you know, with rhetoric about the value of diversity. We all agree diversity is important. What we disagree about is the means used to achieve that diversity.
But is it so important in your view that indeed if you came into a class, if you were teaching and saw that all but one student in the room, everyone else is white, would you say we should be doing something? Is it so important that we should go revisit other values we're pursuing here, given the results I'm seeing, or not that important?
You go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm glad you put that up, because I'm not convinced that diversity is all that important. Diversity in terms of skin color.
Joseph Phillips.
When you talk to college students and people who have been to college and what was most important about their college experience, it had to do not with the color of the person sitting next to them, but the values of the teachers and those kinds of things. Of course, integration is a great thing. I'm for that. I'm for it when people want to do it. Am I for people manipulating and forcing people? I don't think that that's a good thing. I don't think that that's good for America at all. And I also want to make this point. We talk about how great diversity is for the educational benefits of our students, and yet the schools that are routinely churning out the greatest number of black doctors, the greatest number of black lawyers, are HBCUs, which are not racially integrated at all. Morehouse, Spelman, Howard, etc., 99% black. That is not, in my opinion, a bad thing. And if it is, then, Tim, maybe we should make sure that we get a critical mass of white girls down at Spelman and be on our way.
Robert, can I interject something very quickly?
HBCU being historically black colleges and universities. One very brief statement, and then if somebody wants to make a very brief statement from the other side, and then on to closing statements.
I think we have to be very careful with the words integration and segregation as they happen to have drifted into certain implications in our time.
John McWhorter.
Because often the way we're using the word segregation today implies something I'm very uncomfortable with, which is that the only way that black people can really excel is if white people are around. And I'm not comfortable with that. And so we talk about schools, and for me, a dominant image is, for example, KIPP academies, where all the kids are black or brown and poor, and they're being taught very well by dedicated teachers, and there are new KIPP academies every year. And somehow, on the other hand, especially in academia, it seems that we're supposed to keep talking about increasing segregation as if segregation now is always the same thing as it was 40 years ago, when actually a whole lot of black kids, poor black kids in a room together, can learn very well. That excites me. It is peculiar to me how unexciting that seems to be found.
I agree to a brief statement. That was it. And one rebuttal, if you want to make it, from the side opposing the resolution.
Well, I guess the only thing that I'd want to point out to people in listening to this is that this anti-affirmative action argument is really a Trojan horse for a whole range of anti-integration, anti-civil rights, anti-equality policies. You've heard it. The bottom line is this whole Brown versus Board of Education experiment, this whole idea of forced integration was a bad idea when it started, and it's a bad idea now. So what this is a rollback. It's not just about racial preferences, whatever you define that to be. It's about what kind of society we really want to have. And this other side is happy to have societies, to have institutions that are racially separated, to have communities that do not interact with each other, and have all white institutions, all black institutions, and all Asians. That's a rollback on the basic promise of the civil rights movement.
That's
well, you'll all have closing arguments.
That concludes the discussion period. In our remaining time, we'll listen to excerpts from the closing statements. First, Kin Mei Ong concludes her case against the proposition it's time to end affirmative action. Here, she refers to Mr. Pell's organization, which is the Center for Individual Rights, the group that filed the lawsuits in the University of Michigan cases.
Kin Mei Ong.
In talking about diversity and the benefits of diversity, now, the other side makes it seem like we're saying, well, you know, we want racially diverse classes, because if you're black, you have a certain perspective, and you're expected to carry the mantle of that experience, and same with if you're Asian or white or so forth. And that's not what we're saying. There has been mountains of evidence about the benefits of a diverse educational environment and of a diverse workplace that was produced in the University of Michigan cases. This was produced before the court, and I'm sure that Mr. Pell's organization fought that with the best arguments that they had, and the Supreme Court voted in favor of diversity. Also, with regard to the process that educational institutions use to accept students, it's a very flexible, individualized process. The type of admissions plan that was endorsed by the Supreme Court in the University of Michigan case is individualized. There are no quotas. It's not mechanical, because Mr. Pell's organization actually won the case at the undergrad institution, which found that the undergrad policy at the time was too mechanical. So it's a very individualized consideration. And, you know, the last thing I want to leave you with is it's what we call the causation fallacy. Even without affirmative action, whites' chances of admissions it only rises at our most prestigious institutions by 1 to 3%. According to that Bowen and Bach study, the one by the university presidents, it only rose by 1.5% for the average white student. That's because there's a whole lot more white students than minority students that are applying. So even without affirmative action, it's not going to increase individual applicants' chances of getting in by a whole lot. So this whole thing about how every white student that has been admitted, or even every Asian student who, you know, sometimes believes that that's the case, thinks that I would have gotten in if it wasn't about affirmative action, that's simply not true.
The next closing argument is in favor of the motion, and it comes from John McWhorter.
I think that when we're evaluating this debate, a crucial thing to realize is that there's no denial on any of our part that there is inequality in our society. This is the crucial point. Looking at the nation that we're in, looking at the history of the world, looking at the nature of our species, it is logically unclear to me that there ever could be a human society where the playing field was completely level. Now, we can work on things, but it's always going to be imperfect, and it's going to be imperfect enough to matter. You can be committed to social justice while realizing that because society cannot be perfect, what our job is to teach people who didn't come out with as many chips as we would have liked to cope and do the best that they can despite the imperfections of the system. Now, if somebody is down on the bottom, of course, I personally am in favor of there being help, of there being relaxations of standards if necessary. But when this is simply a matter of skin color, I think that we have departed from what the original intentions of these policies were. The issue is not waiting for there to be no inequality or discrimination. The idea is, when do you let it go? Because there's never going to be a society that's completely without it. And in closing, I would like to say that there is evidence pro and con for this, and I don't see on the other side any engagement with the con. There is an understandable sense that their arguments are God's arguments, the only ones worth mattering, and that anybody who has different ideas is funded by sinister people or has a different agenda, et cetera, et cetera. It's not true. To be honest, I've studied their stuff. I know the pro. There are other arguments written by cogent people, many of them not conservatives. These people don't see those arguments as worthy of engagement. Their case, therefore, is incomplete. I think you should vote for us.
That was John McWhorter speaking in favor of the motion, "It's Time to End Affirmative Action." Now we'll hear from Kimberly Crenshaw. In her closing statement, she refers to Proposition 209, which ended affirmative action at California state agencies and institutions in 1996.
When affirmative action was withdrawn at the University of California in Berkeley and in UCLA, the participation of African Americans and Latinos fell to levels that we haven't seen since 1968. When you think about whether you want to vote for this proposal, you should think about whether you're satisfied with the fact that women contractors lost a 35% share of the contracts that they had had in California as the result of 209. When you think about voting for that, you need to think about women as well as people of color. Now, the other side says we don't talk about some of this evidence. Let me tell you something I will talk about. They tell you that students who graduate from Spelman, who go to Morehouse, who go to Howard, miraculously end up doing better than going to the elite institutions that they might otherwise have gotten into. They want you to think that the reason they do better there is that they're over there where they should belong with all the other black people. What they're not telling you is that these institutions have a track record knowing how to encourage students, educate students, to create an environment where students feel confident to do their best. So rather than taking that as an indictment of the institutions that have taken qualified students and not allowed them them to do their best. They follow the track and the proven tradition of focusing on stereotypes about African Americans. So my point is, if you're unhappy with the inferences that are drawn from this position, if you're not a colorblind fundamentalist, then you know that there's still work to be done in this society. You know that this inequality is something that has to be addressed. And you know that just like any other social problem we care about, like asbestos, it would be silly to think we're going to solve asbestos by being asbestos blind. It's silly to think we're going to solve the problem of race by being colorblind.
Kimberly Crenshaw, thank you very much. Now, final remarks from Terrence Pell for the motion, It's Time to End Affirmative Action.
Well, tonight all of us are gathered here to defend the principle of equality, and I think we do that with a sense that equality is under siege as never before, and that's because real equality is never achieved. It's always coming into existence. As our opponents say, there's a lot of work to be done, and that's true. But today, the challenge to equality doesn't come from the political extremes. It comes from really the political middle. Moderates have tried to eliminate differences in achievement among black and white 18-year-olds by essentially engineering an admission system that makes them go away. And with characteristic efficiency, those preferences have been extended to every institution after undergraduate college, including professional schools and public and private employment. Though they aren't intended to do so, these policies perpetuate racial differences, and they corrode social bonds. They make it difficult for minority high school students to attend schools where their credentials would make them academically competitive. And that's the point about the historically black colleges. It's not that blacks ought to go to the HBCUs. It's that the white schools, the elite schools, ought to learn from the way the HBCUs run their admissions programs. They admit on the basis of merit, and it makes a big difference. The most troubling aspect about tonight's debate has been the reaction of our opponents to efforts to disclose the problems and end these policies. Our opponents essentially demand that we continue to wink at real differences in qualification and demand also that we remain discreetly silent about the predictable consequences of this winking. It's time to put an end to race preferences. It may have been a good idea at one point, but it no longer serves a useful purpose. There are too many other important issues that we need to be talking about if we're going to achieve real equality in our lifetime.
And that concludes our debate. The audience was polled a second time at the end of the evening, and those against the motion, It's Time to End Affirmative Action, carried the day. They were ahead in the beginning, 44% to 34%, a 10 percentage point spread. But by the end, they had increased that to a larger spread of 16 percentage points. The final result was 55% against the motion and only 39% for. 6% still didn't know. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC in New York, producer Rob Christensen, executive producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore and Edward Haber with production assistance from Heather Radke. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.
If you could only listen to 2 hours of radio the entire year, the Third Coast Festival broadcast is the program for you. Of course, if you never turn your radio off, this is also the program for you. The Third Coast Festival chooses the best audio documentaries from all over the world in its annual competition, and we've put those winners together in a show of unforgettable radio. Tune in to hear the best of the best.
This afternoon at 1 here on WILL Urbana. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
You're listening to AM 580 WILL Urbana. Thanks for joining us on this Thanksgiving holiday. The National Weather Service says we can expect a high in the upper 30s today with northwest wind 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting to around 25 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-20s with northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow, sunny, highs in the upper 30s with west wind 5 to 10 miles per hour.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection.